Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Publishing eCast on Software-Defined Radio, What You Need to Know. Today's speakers from GE Fanuc, Prism Tech, Red Rapids, and Zelligsoft represent some of the most prominent and credible COTS SDR vendors anywhere in the world. I'm Chris Schufo, Group Editorial Director for OSP's Military and Aerospace Group of Publications and Websites. Of pertinence today to today's eCast are our magazines VME and Critical Systems, Military Embedded Systems, PC-104 and Small Form Factors, and our all-electronic publication, DSP-FPGA.com. I used to think SDR was all about the military, particularly the DoD's Joint Tactical Radio System, or JTRS. But after participating for several years in the SDR forum events, I'm now convinced that there's a healthy civilian ecosystem emerging for SDR, and probably at a pace that's faster than the one in defense. Each of today's speakers is equally comfortable with their company's products in defense and non-military applications, and arguably, they're all domain experts. In today's eCast, Red Rapids talks about the most common pitfalls of assembling a software-defined radio from commodity hardware. I suspect this is actually the formal presentation of an informal conversation I had with our speaker, Ken Sienski, some months back. Prism Tech's Dominic Penascotti addresses the non-trivial topic of SDR tools and middleware. GE Fanuc's Scott Hames brings us up to speed on trends in SDR, attributes of modern COTS SDR modules. And finally, Mark Hermeling of Zelligsoft brings home some practical advice on lessons from the trenches, how to build SDRs with less risk. Mark will be a great closing act for us today, as his briefing will tie a bow around many of the previous speakers' comments and observations. And I'll introduce each speaker and their bio before they begin. Now, some housekeeping items. You'll note a button on your console to enlarge slides. You'll probably need to do this on some of the slides, as they can get quite detailed. You also have the opportunity to download slides, although doing so will stop the automated presentation, preventing our speaker from actually driving. And as far as housekeeping is concerned, with four presenters, the briefing will consume about 50 minutes, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the end. You'll note on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please so note at the beginning of your question. Else, I'll parcel the questions equally to our speakers. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, or perhaps you've got a technical problem, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast to try to resolve it. And note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. Our sponsors have asked us to insert several very brief poll questions during the eCast. If one of these pops up on your screen, we do ask that you'll take 30 seconds or so to check the boxes and answer the questions. And oh yes, before I forget, we always get this question. So up front, let me tell you that the eCast will be posted online within 48 hours, and an audio podcast will also be available. More details at the end. So are we ready? Let's go. I'm pleased to introduce Ken Sienski, president and co-founder of Red Rapids. Ken is the president and co-founder of Red Rapids, as I just said, should have struck that line out. He has over 20 years' experience in the development of digital transceiver hardware that forms the critical bridge between the analog and digital domain of a software-defined radio. Sorry about that, Ken, but you're up.
All right. Thank you, Chris. I want to take this opportunity to share some of the observations we've made over the years working with SDR system integrators. For those of you not familiar with Red Rapids, we're a supplier of open architecture transceiver products that are applied to everything from communication systems to active radar. Some of you may also know us by the name Red River. We changed the company name last year to eliminate the ongoing confusion with more than 1,000 other companies in this region named Red River. So finally, we get all the correct phone calls and all the correct packages to our address. Since our products are general purpose by design, we get to work with a pretty wide variety of customers in both the commercial and the defense market segments. Today I want to summarize some of the recurring issues we find our customers facing when they assemble complete SDR systems from commercial products. These systems typically consist of three major components: an RF converter that has been designed for a specific band of interest, an IF to baseband converter that acts as the hardware bridge between the analog and digital domains, and usually some type of programmable baseband processor that can host the modem function. And this typically addresses your QPSK, FM, AM demodulation and modulation, whatever type of system you might be trying to design. The number of product options tends to increase exponentially as you move from the somewhat niche RF equipment to the commodity computers typically used for baseband processing. So what are the challenges that are facing the modern SDR designer? Well, first of all, the radio transceivers are available in a pretty wide variety of open standards. So the biggest problem you may be confronted with is trying to pick the host platform of choice. There are products in the server and desktop architecture domain, which is supported by PCI, PCIX, and PCI Express. And for those of you that might be a little bit confused with that terminology, the PCI specification has undergone a number of upgrades over the years. And one of the most confusing qualities here is that PCIX is actually not PCI Express. PCI Express is PCIe, and that seems to trip up a lot of our customers frequently. Embedded architectures such as VME or Compact PCI are supported by PMC, PMCX, and XMC mezzanine products. Just like the PCI specification, the PMC specification has evolved over the years to accommodate these new buses, PCIX for PMCX and XMC for PCI Express. Now, there's also mobile architectures available, such as laptop computers or PC-104, and these are supported typically by Cardbus and Express cards. And yes, once again, Cardbus is the legacy PCI specification, and Express card is that same form factor updated to include the new PCI Express protocols. Within each category, there are seemingly endless number of vendor choices and processor architectures, so this becomes a very confusing point as people try to put their SDR architectures in place. Now, not all general-purpose computers are really suitable for SDR applications, and this is really what we're going to talk about throughout this presentation. There are power and cooling considerations beyond the typical expansion card concerns. There are also electromagnetic noise issues that you don't usually confront with a commercial expansion card. It's not quite the same as just grabbing a new graphics card for your gaming system and plugging it in. A lot of SDR developers have no reference for realistic bus bandwidth expectations. Again, this type of information is not usually available from your typical commercial computer vendor, so we wind up with customers at times specifying a system with expectations of getting close to peak bandwidth through the receiver front end, and as you probably most of you know, that's not really practical in just a general purpose computer. And then finally, we find that a number of customers really don't consider all of the system contributions to dynamic range performance. There's usually a great deal of focus on the number of A to D converter bits, and really this is only one of many factors that are going to affect the dynamic range of your entire radio. Some of the points that I just made are probably self-evident to many of you, but you have to keep in mind that software-defined radio brings together multiple engineering disciplines. It's really rare to find an individual that's equally well-versed in radio performance metrics, computer architectures, digital signal processing algorithms, and software programming. The ideal scenario is that a team of engineers would be brought together to develop a project, but that's not always the case. And in fact, a large percentage of customer inquiries come from companies that don't have a broad base of in-house expertise. So they rely on a radio front-end specialist to make a baseband processor selection or maybe a modem algorithm expert to pick an appropriate RF front-end. The danger with this approach, of course, is that it becomes easy to set some fundamentally incorrect performance expectations for the complete radio. So the first thing we're going to talk about here are the power considerations when you're picking your architecture. This is going to seem incredibly obvious, but the first thing you really need to look at is whether or not the host computer supplies all of the necessary voltages for the add-in transceiver card that you may have selected. What we have found over the years is that several manufacturers omit the plus and minus 12-volt rail, which is not used on every expansion card, but certainly there are some RF cards or analog front-end cards that do need this higher voltage. The 3.3-volt supply is also a concern because on many of the single-board computers or on many of the adapter cards, what you'll find is that the DC to DC converter has some fundamental current limit that is going to reduce the total amount of power that can be brought to your card. So what is the maximum power allowed by specification? Well, first of all, it depends on which specific type of card you're using. The PCI and PCIX specification allows 25 watts maximum per expansion card. The PCI Express specification is a little bit more complex. Basically, there's a 10-watt limit if you're using a half-length or low-profile card with a single-lane configuration. There's a 25-watt maximum that applies to the by-4, the by-8, and the by-16 cards that are not longer than half-length. And then there's a 75-watt maximum that applies only to by-16 graphics cards. However, you can only dissipate that amount of power after the initialization at 25 watts. PCMCIA modules, which are used primarily in laptops, have a little bit different power limitation. The issue here is really the thermal consideration. The 32-bit PC card cannot exceed 2.5 watts, which places a pretty heavy restriction on just how much electronics you can put into that small footprint. The new Express Card 34 has an even lower power requirement. You cannot exceed 1.3 watts, and the Express Card 54 cannot go over 2.1 watts. Now, the PMC and CMC specifications, which are the foundation of a lot of the transceiver hardware in this market, started with a 7.5 watt maximum power dissipation per card. Now, that has become terribly unrealistic over time as we've begun to use higher speed A-to-D converters and more complex processors, particularly FPGAs, and most modern cards really can't stay within that budget. Along came Vita 32 later on that defined a processor PMC, which really does not impose that maximum power. They basically leave that open to the individual developer and basically leave it to your own risk that your card will actually find a socket that can supply the necessary power. Don't forget to consider the current draw on each voltage also when you pick the power supply for your host platform. It's sometimes difficult to figure out, particularly in a general-purpose computer, just how much of each current is being drawn by the motherboard, but it's very important that you pick a supply that can feed both the motherboard and the expansion cards that you're adding. Okay, moving on to the cooling considerations, one of the big questions or big problems that confronts developers of SDR platforms is whether or not the host computer is capable of cooling a high-power expansion card. If you look at the power draw of many of these cards and the types of computers are being plugged into, there's really a fundamental mismatch. Desktop computers in particular have a notoriously poor airflow across the PCI cards. So if you crack open a Dell computer or a typical HP, what you're usually going to find is that there's no direct airflow on the PCI cards themselves. Most of it is directed over the processors and the memory. Now, servers generally provide adequate airflow, but now you have to beware of the fan controllers. They can actually introduce noise sources that we'll discuss on the next slide. Airflow to mezzanine cards are often obstructed by SBC heat sinks. Typically, as a processor designer, the SBC manufacturer likes to locate the CPU chips in the most advantageous place possible on the card to catch the inlet air, and what this tends to do is then block the air to the PMC socket. So as you're adding mezzanine cards to a VME or a CPCI type of host, one of the things you usually have to look at is just how much airflow is actually reaching the PMC socket. And then finally, laptops, if that's your platform of choice, they are regulated by the PCMCIA specification to support the maximum power that can be dissipated in a card. Unfortunately, what you find is some manufacturers ignore that, and the PCMCIA card itself becomes the heatsink to a CPU. The second bullet on this chart kind of really tells the tale. A little airflow goes a long way. This contour plot was generated from a thermal model we created from one of our PMC receiver cards. The right side of the board consists of the analog circuitry, digitizer, and frequency synthesizer that's used to generate the sample clock. These components are blocked from direct airflow by an EMI shield that is included in the model. This is the reason that you don't see the outline of an individual heat sources in that section of the board. The metal shield is actually acting as a near isothermal heat sink. The left side of the board consists of a very large Vertex 4 FPGA. In this case, it was an LX160, and four high-speed QDR SRAM chips that share a large finned heat sink. You can see from this plot that just 150 LFM increase in airflow reduces peak component temperatures by 10 degrees. You'll also notice that the heat spreads through the power planes of the circuit board, so there's actually a lot to be gained by directing airflow over both sides of the cards, as we did in this simulation. Next, I want to address the electromagnetic noise. Noise generated anywhere in the computer can be coupled to your transceiver through the power supply. There's several sources of noise within the computer that you could run into, one being switching regulators that are used to generate the power supplies to the processor, memory, and peripherals. Usually these are done with switching regulators, and they can generate low-frequency interference. You'll also find these types of switching power supplies on the actual expansion card, so you could be chasing down a noise source on your motherboard when, in fact, it's really coming from a PCI card located somewhere else in the computer. Pulse width modulated fan controllers have become a new source of noise in modern computers. This is a cheap and easy way to change the RPM of the fan in your server, and unfortunately it's a 12-volt square wave that's being pulse width modulated to change the RMS voltage to the fan, but that square wave is also acting as a signal source inside of your radio. The key here is to really select a host with a high-quality power supply and an isolated fan controller circuit. And if you can't find a motherboard that has an isolated fan controller circuit, there are actually third-party controllers available that you can add into a computer. The bus clock is another source of noise that you'll frequently see in a software-defined radio. Basically, what you're seeing is the PCI clock act as an interferer, just as an outside signal would. You can also see simultaneous switching logic generate noise into the power supply. So you really, again, want to select a host that offers you the best advantage possible. And what you really need here is a spread spectrum bus clock so that you can minimize that power. Cooling fans are a source of magnetic interference. And unfortunately, the RF shields that you find on most RF equipment are not equipped to mitigate that interference. They are for electrical noise only. They really don't do much for the magnetic interference. If we look at the plots on the next page, this gives you some examples of the interference I've been talking about. The first plot there up in the upper left is actually an FFT of a continuous wave being input to the receiver inside of a desktop computer. Basically, the kind of unique quality of this card is that it actually has 30 dB gain in front of the A to D converter, so we're actually amplifying the noise sources for the purpose of this particular demonstration. It's a little unusual to locate a high-gain stage on a PCI card. Signal amplification is usually performed in the RF converter. However, we offer this product option for customers that need a tight analog gain control loop as part of the signal recovery algorithm that they want to implement in the software radio. There's usually a higher latency command and control path between the baseband processor and the RF front end, so this sometimes allows you to do things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. The FFT plot shown in blue illustrates the spectral lines produced by a continuous wave carrier and the associated harmonics. You will notice that the spectral lines produced by the 66 MHz PCI clock is not confined to a single frequency bin. The frequency of this clock is continuously scanning across a few hundred kilohertz to spread out the energy. The amplitude of the fundamental frequency would increase if the host computer did not offer this feature. Of course, you wouldn't even see the spur without the gain stage. It is usually buried well below the noise floor in a typical PCI transceiver. The second plot shown here is a spectrogram. You can think of this plot as a time sequence of vertical FFT snapshots viewed from above. The x-axis is the time and the y-axis is the frequency. The color shades indicate amplitude. So the dark red line represents a continuous carrier wave signal that is always present. The yellow represents low energy noise present in band. You'll notice rectangular clusters of noise at evenly spaced intervals in this plot. These correspond to the burst transfer of data from the receiver card to the host over the PCI bus. So this source of noise is actually occurring from the switching of the bus drivers themselves. Again, this example has been staged to produce the desired results, but these type of noise sources are present in every system. The degree to which they affect your performance would depend on the quality of the equipment that you select and also on your particular application. You may have digital filters that actually remove a lot of this noise before they actually reach your demodulation function. Okay, next is bandwidth consideration. This seems somewhat obvious, but bus transfer speed is not limited by the actual transceiver or the amount of FIFOing you put on the transceiver. I get asked this question a lot when people are evaluating products, but fundamentally, you either have the bandwidth available on your bus or you don't. The transceiver DMA engine can consume every available bus cycle. There's really no software involved in that transaction. It arbitrates for the bus and starts shooting data into the memory. So adding a FIFO will overcome a bus latency, but it really won't improve the bandwidth any. Interrupt latency is a concern in non-real-time operating systems, but this can be overcome by using more advanced scatter-gather DMA techniques to optimize the performance of the data transfers. So the second thing you need to look at for bandwidth considerations is what is the absolute maximum bandwidth supported by the specification. I won't go through each one of these in detail, but suffice it to say, as the PCI specification has evolved over time, bandwidth has increased correspondingly. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, dynamic range considerations seem to trip folks up as much as anything. Basically, with the advent of 16-bit wideband A to D converters, it's now possible to build transceivers with higher than 95 dB of spur-free dynamic range. You can even get 110 dB across specific narrow bands. A typical ADC requires 7 to 11 dBm of signal power to reach full scale, and adding gain to the front end, as we've shown you before, is not a good idea to do on the card that's in the actual computer because you can pick up noise, so you really want to add those amplifiers up in the RF stage. However, it requires a lot of power to really produce a very high quality amplified signal. ADC sample clock quality also directly impacts dynamic range. Phased noise can dominate channels adjacent to high power input signals, and you're all very familiar with seeing this as a noise pedestal in a typical FFT. And then there's also reference burrs to worry about from the frequency synthesizer that's actually generating those ADC sample clocks. The RF front end also has to achieve the expected performance, or it really does you no good to pick an A to D that has a high degree of dynamic range. So this thermal noise floor should be set lower than the ADC signal to noise, and the harmonics generated from multiple input signals will also appear as spurs. So those really need to be taken into account when you evaluate the overall spur-free dynamic range of your system. And then finally, binary computation accuracy must also exceed the processing gain. 16-bit arithmetic typically is no longer adequate for processing signals all the way through a series of filters or through an FFT. So you basically want at least 18 bits, if not more. And FPGA designs in particular must conserve significant bits through the entire data path. So rounding noise and overflow makes it difficult to maintain 95 dB through a series of complex mass transforms. And I think that will do it for my presentation, Chris. Hope I didn't intimidate our audience with this presentation. I can assure you we have many customers that have overcome all of these obstacles and have systems fielded around the clock in the field today.
All right. Well, thanks, Ken. I was nodding my head vigorously as you were going through some of the thermal and EMI slides, so I'd like to dig into that a little bit more offline. Thanks very much. Next up is Dominic Paniscotti, PrismTech's VP of SDR Products. I recently met Dominic for the first time at an SDR forum meeting when he was here local to the Pacific Northwest, and am pleased to have him attending today's eCast. Dominic is a well-respected figure within the software-defined radio community, and he's been involved in the design and development of SDRs since 1998. He is one of the original software architects of the Joint Tactical Radio System, or JTRS, Software Communications Architecture, SCA, and is co-founder of the Object Management Group, OMG, Software Radio DSIG, kind of a mouthful, recently renamed the Software-Based Communication Task Force. Dom holds a BSEE from Fairleigh Dickinson University. Dom's other credentials, which I'll omit here for time's sake, are equally as impressive. Over to you, Dominic.
Thanks, Chris. Just a little bit of background on who PrismTech is, for those of you who don't know PrismTech. PrismTech is basically a productivity tools and middleware company, software middleware company, and today I'll be speaking to you specifically about SDR tools and SDR middleware and how they help minimize overhead, speed your development times, ensure quality and conformance, and facilitate reuse, and this in direct contrast to Ken's hardware presentation. A little bit about PrismTech's customer base. PrismTech's customer base is basically built up around a set of Fortune 500 companies, both in the military aerospace sector and commercial communications sector. In terms of our partners in the SDR arena, you'll see here that, for example, we have an OEM agreement in place with Rockwell Collins to actually bundle our tools and middleware around some of their radio systems. We also have partner agreements in place with some of the major real-time operating system vendors in the space, as well as FPGA vendors such as Altera and chip vendors such as TI. Okay, so to enough of the PrismTech overview, to jump into my presentation here, basically the point to be made is that the business case for software-defined radios are becoming increasingly clearer. In essence, networking terminal reconfiguration without hardware upgrades is becoming very important in order to allow you to field software either post-fielding hardware or to update software systems in the field, that hardware in the field. Certainly, being able to reduce your time to market for providing new functionality is important, and basically the standards behind these SDRs facilitate that. Increasing user choice, thereby reducing vendor lock-in, is also another important aspect of the standardization or the software standardization of these systems, as is developing portable applications and promoting reuse across radio platforms, both within an organization. I mean, this reuse is important both within an organization to drive costs down, but it's also important across organizations as to create an ecosystem of third-party vendors who can actually provide software to these systems. And, of course, SDRs bring along for the ride all the capital expenditure and operational expenditure cost advantages. Okay, so that's great. That's what SDRs are hoping to bring to the community. But SDRs are pretty much a multidimensional technical challenge. So as Ken showed you in his presentation, basically there are both varying heterogeneous hardware architectures in play, as well as networking technologies, bus technologies, operating system technologies. Here in the space, you'll find general purpose processors, digital signal processors, field programmable gate arrays, as well as ASICs and A to Ds, and much of what Ken took you through. But on the software side of things, again, you'll find the operating systems, network technologies, also the middleware capabilities that that help abstract these hardware buses, the component frameworks that are the standards for these SDRs around supporting the deployment and configuration of the software that runs on them, as well as all of the different application abstractions that need to be created to hide the physical hardware elements. And a big aspect, again, is standards compliance, and there's lots of others. Okay, so in terms of SDR, the message is that basically SDRs are really no longer an in-R&D or craft industry. A lot of major OEMs are starting to ship SDRs today, and if you run a Google search, you'll run into probably 50 of them. COTS tools and operating environments are now available from multiple vendors to help you manage some of these complexities, and I'll talk to you a little bit about those. And major OEMs are quickly adopting these COTS product, again, to try to build up this third-party ecosystem that's really required here to make SDRs a successful endeavor. So as someone who's looking to build an SDR, at least from the software side of things, what are you looking for? Well, what you're looking for is, in essence, some domain-specific tools that allow you to provide the best productivity, performance, and compliance to the standards that you're trying to build to. You're also looking for integrated development solutions to help you minimize your cycle times. And these solutions have to support the entire life cycle. They have to support the life cycle all the way from the modeling aspects all the way through the deployment aspects, and an integrated IDE is an important aspect. You're looking for pre-integrated platforms because they offer you the lowest runtime overhead with the highest performance at the lowest cost. And you're also looking for domain expertise because this is just not a simple ITT problem. Throwing some Java programmers or C++ programmers or C programmers at it is not really going to solve your problem. Okay, so to that end, speaking to the domain-specific tools aspect of it, domain-specific tools are all about maximizing productivity and raising the level of abstraction at which your developers have to operate in. So here you see a snapshot of PrismTech's Spectra Power Tools. And what these tools do is they allow the developers to naturally express their design in a graphical format, and then to take that design and transform it directly into the artifacts, into the software artifacts, such as the C++ code or C code or VHDL code that's required to actually deploy out onto the end target. These tools, in essence, codify all the knowledge of the domain experts in the space and therefore pass that on to the folks who are using them, much like compilers pass on all the domain expertise of compiler experts and assembly language experts in the space. These tools also facilitate conformance to standards, again, as they codify the expertise of these industry experts and the standards that they've actually helped build and evolve. Okay. But again, it's not just about modeling. It's about an integrated development environment. So once you've got some of this modeling performed and your waveform modeling is performed and your radio platform modeling is performed, you have to be able to map these models directly onto the physical operating systems and physical hardware that you're trying to execute on. And so here you'll see, again, it's a snapshot of our tools, how you do this. This is an example of mapping some software onto an Integrity operating system, Green Hills Integrity operating system, for example. And again, now taking that even further, once you've done that mapping, you're going to want to automate the build and testing aspects of that software, and so you're going to want to integrate into the tools that these RTOS vendors actually provide. And so here you see, again, how our tools physically map through to these different RTOSs and actually allow the compilation, the debugging, and the deployment out onto target. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the tooling, but to come back to it, SDRs are not all about the software. They're also about the hardware. However, what they are about is trying to abstract that hardware in such a manner that you can actually move your software designs across different disparate pieces of hardware. And here, the diagram at the bottom tries to show, in essence, an abstraction of the physical hardware at the very bottom of the screen. This is called an operating environment in kind of SDR software speak these days. And above those are actually the software components that have to communicate with each other. And the goal is to allow these to be readily moved from all these between these disparate pieces of hardware. Again, you're looking for an integrated and optimized and high-performance operating environment, so you don't want this to take up the entire assets or entire resources of these particular pieces of hardware, especially as you move down onto DSPs and to FPGAs. And to that end, you'll see there are some examples of the kind of goals that you should have in mind in terms of footprint requirements on these types of operating environments in these systems. Okay, so to just give you a feel for the the kind of life cycle here, again, you're looking to provide sets of modeling tools at the very front end of the process. These modeling tools allow you to basically build software that's correct by construction. Okay, so those tools generate here on the upper right-hand side the actual software artifacts, the C++ code or C code or XML files or whatever that's required. And then those files can be transformed directly into the target artifacts that are required and ultimately deployed across the physical operating environments that we just spoke about a second ago. All right, so the takeaways are that implementing SDRs is not easy, so you need to look for a vendor partner with SDR implementation expertise. You need domain-specific SDR development tools to maximize your productivity and that allow this third-party ecosystem to evolve. You need integrated operating environments that minimize your overhead cycle time and cost, and look for solutions that address development and deployment, which ultimately minimize your integration headaches. And so just a small announcement here of Prism Tech's Spectra 2 product, which is was just released yesterday. Basically, a Spectra 2 solution comes with full SDR professional service with the leading experts in the field that stand behind them, the SDR domain-specific tools themselves that I just described to you, and the SDR operating environments that are integrated, optimized, high performance, and deployable across all the different disparate pieces of hardware that are required. And thanks for your time.
All right, Dominic, thank you very much. And for those of you who are taking a look at this slide, Dominic's the guy in the upper left, just in case you wanted to put a face to the voice. Next, we're going to hear from GE Fanuc Embedded Systems Sensor Processing. Our speaker today is Scott Hames, MBA, Director, Applications Engineering and Customer Support. Scott studied electronics at St. Lawrence College and also holds an MBA from the Richard Ivey School of Business, University of Western Ontario, a place I also studied. His 13 years at the company have included positions in hardware and test and field applications engineering. Scott, over to you.
Thanks very much, Chris. I guess a little bit of introduction is probably required for the new name on the company. GE Fanuc has recently acquired Radstone Embedded Computing, of which we were a part. So this area of business is a little bit new for GE Fanuc, but the people who are in it, myself and our staff, have actually got a long background in data acquisition and SDR. So this presentation is really intended to provide a quick overview of the state of the art in terms of SDR hardware, and particularly COTS modules such as digital receivers. And these are the basic building blocks of software-defined radios. Whereas companies like Prism Tech do handle the software end of things, GE Fanuc is much more on the hardware side, and we're going to focus on that today. I'll take a look at the hardware specifications that are defining COTS modules and try and make a few predictions about what to expect in the next 12 to 18 months. If you're looking at migrating an application you've got now to an SDR platform, or if you've encountered problems with analog radio hardware that you can't solve and you think that SDR may help, well, then this presentation is probably going to be for you, and I hope you find it informative. Before we really get started, we want to take a quick look and say, well, where are we now? So true software-defined radio, which is for most intents and purposes defined as direct antenna sampling, moving the digital domain right out to the antenna, is still proving elusive except for some really low-frequency applications. For the most part, the components such as ADCs and DACs that are the basis of COTS modules still leave quite a gap between the SDR theory that's predicted and the practical application. Very few A to D converters, or D to A converters for that matter, have the combination of multi-gigahertz sample rate and high dynamic range that are required to do that direct antenna sampling or conversion of signals in cases that are higher than a few hundred megahertz. So even with the hardware that we've got today, it is possible to have true software-defined radio, quote-unquote, operation in some of the lower frequency ranges, sort of HF and some VHF. And if you've been looking around on the internet, you've probably found that there are companies out there advertising some parts that are capable of higher frequency operation that do have that combination of really fast sample rate into the gigahertz, possibly tens of gigahertz with good bit resolution. But these are really based on exotic materials such as superconductors, and that requirement to keep things cooled in liquid nitrogen really makes them difficult for deployment in a lot of real-world environments. Now, because of the state of the hardware today, most of the fielded SDRs, and there are quite a few systems out there that are actually in the field, still perform a lot of the signal conditioning using analog front ends. And in that regard, they really, I think the best way to describe them is sort of digitally assisted analog rather than true SDR. They usually are using that analog front end to bring the signals down to about a more friendly intermediate frequency, something like 70 megahertz or in some cases 160 megahertz. Another promise of the theoretical SDR is the ability of radio modules to be really flexible and be able to be adaptable almost on the fly to any application simply by changing software or possibly some firmware. And while a lot of progress has been made in that area, there's still aspects of some module architectures that can limit the performance in some situations. And I'm sure that the Red Rapids guys have come across this, but if you buy some third-party off-the-shelf units, you find that very often they're optimized for one particular application, say something that requires multiple channel synchronization, like a MIMO kind of environment, or at the other end of the spectrum, maybe something that's designed to support widely varying channel bandwidths. I guess the idea that we're really trying to get across is that one size does not fit all, at least not yet. And while it's true, Chris made the comment early on that it's not just SDR is not just a military technology. and there are civilian applications that are really getting some traction. The fact of the matter is that in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, the military space and military and aerospace applications are really the ones that have been driving the development. And what I've noticed as probably the biggest change in as a COTS vendor is the requirement for rugged product that is not going to be operated in the lab, is going to be operated out in the field, and it could be in very hostile environments, sort of minus 40 to plus 85 temperature range, high shock and vibe, and pretty much zero airflow in a lot of cases. To sort of state this graphically, I think, you know, this is a picture that most people who've done some SDR work have seen, you know, the migration from the old pure analog radio through a sort of digitally assisted analog area, which is kind of where we are at the present, to a true SDR model. And as I said, you know, I think that, you know, we're either here or we expect to be here very soon for VHF applications, and probably moving up in the next sort of year and a half, 2 years to UHF to that model. So with that in mind, you know, what we might want to say is, okay, well, what's new in COTS SDR models? Where are trends taking us? You know, what are we seeing? And the thing that we're starting to see now is that after a period of for lack of a better description, stagnation, that there's kind of a second generation of SDR technology emerging, and you know, new components are basically pushing this. The basic truth is that COTS module performance, if you're at a board level, is really determined by the available components that the manufacturers are going to use. And in the last sort of 12 months, we've really seen a new crop of A to Ds and D to As coming out that are offering substantially better performance than what we had, say, 3, 4, 5 years ago. You know, A to Ds. Now we're seeing A to Ds that have got 14-bit performance going out to as high as 400 megahertz, maybe higher, and DACs that are running 16 bits at up to a gigahertz, or again, maybe higher, so that these things are really going to allow improvements in board-level performance. And as the Red Rapids presentation sort of implied, you know, you can't just go by the A to D converter specs on determining how practical something is going to be to implement. And complementing these new A to D and D to A components are new approaches in data transfer, and particularly high-speed serial buses. That's really letting you get access to that new high-bandwidth data. It's one thing to be able to digitize the data at a high rate, but if you can't move it off the board, if you can't get it to the processing engine, it's really wasted. Along with these things, we're also seeing new form factors and environmental specifications that are coming out to allow deployment of this hardware in the field. And as you all know, FPGAs are key to a lot of onboard signal processing that happens on these COTS modules. And as with anything else, there's new components that are allowing new things to be happening on board. So let's have a quick look at, you know, changes in the A to D converter landscape. You know, just as COTS SDR modules are the building blocks of an SDR, ADCs and DACs are the fundamental building blocks of digital transceivers. And while downstream DSP can improve signal quality in the digital domain, and that's one of the big benefits of SDR, speed and resolution of the ADC are critical parameters that are going to determine where things start in the DSP chain, and the ability of an SDR module to carry bandwidth, how sensitive it's going to be, and in some cases how selective your radio can be. As many of you know, several new A to Ds have been announced that are setting new standards for speed and resolution, and these components are just starting to show up in digital receiver modules. So I guess the thing that we take away here is that you know, expect to see some exciting new capability in the next year or so. On the transmit side of things, DAC components are also showing a lot of improvement, and there's also a trend that we're not really seeing in the typical ADC plot. And on the DAC side, you know, we're really seeing simultaneous increases in both speed and resolution, not a sort of mutual exclusivity that we see on the ADC side. And what the plot really doesn't show here is also the trend towards feature-rich interpolating architectures that are going to allow the user to supply the data at a baseband rate and then allow the hardware to really do the grunt work of up-converting signals to an intermediate frequency or a carrier frequency. And while these interpolating DACs can be highly effective in communication scenarios, as I said, they may not be suitable for either wideband applications such as radar exciters or for applications that are demanding multi-channel synchronization. So I guess that the takeaway from that idea is that, you've got to read the fine print on selecting a DAC to make sure that it's going to fit your application.
Scott, this is Chris.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm watching the clock, and I know that we still have to allow some time for our last speaker. So I'm going to actually ask you if you could perhaps economize a little bit on your slides so that we can get the last briefing in as well as allow the audience to ask some questions. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay, Chris. I understand completely. So what I'll do is I'll try and skip through these fairly quickly, and those who want to have a better look at the slides, they will be available online. Okay, as I said, high-speed serial data buses are really going to allow us to take advantage of some of these higher-speed A to D converters and D to A converters. And one of the nice benefits of the high-speed serial buses is that they're quite similar at the physical layer, so that they allow one module to serve multiple applications just by software or firmware reprogramming. VPX is one that you're going to see a lot about, especially in the military aerospace, mainly because of its ability for the ability to ruggedize it and support for high-speed serial connections and some backwards compatibility with the VME bus. So again, those who want more information can find that online after the fact. So as a quick review, let's look back a few years and say, well, what was a typical SDR module looking like in about 2002? And, you had sort of 14-bit 105 megahertz A to D, 12-bit 210 megahertz A to D, a lot of work still done in ASICs, and although FPGAs were on board, the processing power in them was somewhat modest. And again, bus bandwidth's a real limiting factor on getting data off the card. And then if you compare that to what we're probably likely to see late this year or early next year is something that's got considerably better speed resolution trade-off on the A to D converters and the ability to move that data off the board or do the DSP on the card. A couple of things about deployment. As I said, sort of long story short, one size does not fit all. You really want to make sure that the architecture of the card that you're selecting is proper for your application. Take something like spectrum monitoring, where you might have simultaneous wideband and narrowband applications. Make sure that the back-end architecture of the card will support that operation. And then same thing can be said to be true for something that's requiring heavy-duty multi-channel sync, like a MIMO application, that the memory architecture may need to be optimized to really make that work. And finally, a couple of ideas to keep in mind when selecting an SDR module. What's your multi-channel synchronization requirement like? Does the architecture support it? And are you going to be able to synchronize to other third-party equipment? Thanks a lot, Chris, and I'll let you take it from there.
Okay, thanks very much, Scott. And last but not least is Mark Hermeling, Director, Applications Engineering at Zelligsoft. Mark has an established track record of accomplishment in software engineering processes, model-based design, and development and testing of complex embedded systems. At Zelligsoft, he built the applications and custom engineering teams and holds numerous executive and technical functions at the company. His corporate experience includes ObjectTime, Rational Software, and IBM, and serving global Fortune 500 customers. And I'm sorry that we don't have as much time as we had hoped to everyone, but we're not going to shortchange Mark, who is basically our cleanup act. So go ahead, Mark. Take it off, please.
Thank you very much there, Chris. The benefit of being the last act is always that the stage has pretty much been set for you. Unfortunately, that also leaves you with a little bit less time. So I'm going to quickly flip through the seven or eight slides that I have here for the audience. And as Scott said, the slides will be available afterwards as well. So feel free to have a more thorough look and send us an email if you want some more information. Zelligsoft is a company focusing on component-based software development. Component-based software development is one of the things that really revolutionized SDR, as it allows you to split an entire application into individual pieces that can then be deployed to a platform. So there's a very strong separation between software and platform, making the software layer independent of the platform layer. And ZelixSoft really, we've been very proud to be the providing the leading development provider for SDR since our inception in about 2002. We've been working with a lot of different companies, as you can see at the right-hand side of the slide, and not just in the in the U.S. There's lots of interest in this also in the international space, in Asia, as you can see there. ZelixSoft approach to the market is that we actually focus on being the tool provider. We provide the software engineering expertise, and then we partner with other companies that provide that are best-in-class vendors of the other pieces of technology that you need for an SDR. And as the previous speakers have already said, there are so many different pieces that you need. ZelixSoft's position on this is that taking the best-in-class vendors allows everybody to focus on their niche expertise, and we'll integrate that and make sure that that works for you. Some of the success stories that we've had in the past that you can find more information on the website as well is one of the first military/commercial SATCOM systems in the UK with East Astrium. We've been involved in all of the JTRS cluster projects as the leading modeling and development tool, as well as some of the other U.S. projects. ZelixSoft really provides the most platform-independent development environment as we basically support all of the different platforms that are available in the market right now. So as the speakers before me have said already, SDRs are very complex embedded systems. And one of the things that I like to highlight to my customers is that there's different types of SDR. And Scott pointed to that a little bit already, saying that he calls it digital assisted analog. If you look at the military market is really stressing the technology the furthest that it can go. But if you look at the commercial market, they have much less requirements for dynamic frequency range, but they're also doing SDR. They're doing a slightly different form of SDR. So you can really see there's a sliding scale from military to commercial and from handheld to fixed location type of SDR systems. At the same time, there's a sliding level of software that's used in these SDRs, and that really goes from control to low-level signal processing. And at the lower-level signal processing, you'll run into a lot of the problems that Ken pointed to at the first presentation. There's heterogeneous hardware. There's vastly different engineering domains because of all these differences in SDR, and there's vastly different portability and reusability requirements. Portability for military taking away form and putting that on different pieces of hardware. Reusability for commercial, where one wireless infrastructure vendor wants to reuse their own technology, their own decoders and stuff, and across multiple product lines. So one of the things that I've always helped my customers with managing complexity is build a little, test a little. If you are stepping into a new technology arena, the best thing that you can do is to build something, test it. Build it, test it. Iteratively add functionality as you go. And execute that on a host and target. There's, of course, different things that you can do with a host machine versus a target machine, the target machine having the real signal processing capability, but a lot of the load of an SDR can actually be executed or simulated on a host machine, and the waveform to platform independence actually allows you to do that very nicely. So and that's also one of the places where component-based technologies help you. They make it really easy to compile something for Linux, real-time Linux, whatever you have, execute it there with powerful processors, powerful debuggers, and then run that later, that same load later on your real target machine with Integrity, VxWorks, whatever, what else you have. And that also helps you because frequently the hardware that you really want to execute on might not be available, might be partially available, might not be as reliable as you want it to be. So what does ZelixSoft do in this? We help you reduce the development risk. We help you model early. We help you to generate. We help you to code early, compile, and run that iteratively on different pieces of platform. We help you to model that platform independence and communicate that across your team. So you really get a cycle of model, code, integrate, test, model, code, integrate, test as often as possible. And that's what our main product, ZelixSoft CE, provides you the backbone of the process, provides you this modeling tool that you can then generate into different types of source code that you can compile, integrate, and execute and test on host and target. And as one of the things that we do to back this up is that we actually have an evaluation package available that you can download from us, that you can actually try and try this technology on your host machines with, get up and running quickly, and switch to target when you're ready. So I think that's the quickest I can run through the slides there, Chris.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. I couldn't even get my finger on the unmute button that quickly. So thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate that, and I want to say thank you to all of our speakers. Let's get right to the Q&A. The clock says we have about 5 minutes. I'm going to extend it by a minute or two because we literally have dozens of questions already queued up, and I know that this is, for most of you in the audience, the most interesting part of the entire presentation. So the first question I'm going to go ahead and send off to Zelligsoft, which operating systems do you support?
That's always an interesting question. We support any operating system. We'll allow our customers to use any operating system that they want. Out of the box, there's a bunch of them that we support, which includes the favorite Integrity, VxWorks, Linux, and those. But if you have a slightly different operating system, if you have something homegrown that you want to support, we definitely can do that as well.
Okay, thank you. This next question doesn't have a person's name attached to it, but it showed up, I believe, during Dominic's presentation from Prison Tech. So I'm going to toss this one to you, Dominic, and if this doesn't make sense, then we'll open it up to everybody. And it says, did this software package get used on the ICOM radio in the picture on the slide we saw? Does that sound familiar to you, Dominic?
No, I'm not sure, but it's possible that it's one of the pictures on our slide. I'm not sure if that radio was one of the ones that was targeted with our product, though, or not. So probably best to move on to another question.
Okay. All right. This is a question for all of you, so feel free to chime in, whoever does so first. Are software reuse tools readily utilized in the SDR sector? Anyone?
I can jump in on that one. Yes, certainly software reuse tools are utilized in the sector, tools ranging anywhere from refactoring tools and the like. Those are typically used down at the very lowest levels of the development chain. In essence, tools such as ours from Prism Tech that we provide also kind of fall into this category, as they support reverse engineering features and allow you to retarget your software onto different operating systems, different middleware.
Okay. Anyone else care to comment on that?
Yeah, I have a slightly different a take on that same question. My stance would be not as much as the vendors would actually like. People are actually developing the software, and they are taking their entire application and splitting it out in multiple different units that are actually reusable, and they are getting some reuse out of it, but the actual amount of reuse out of these different components that they actually have is probably not as high as they want, definitely across different types of processor cards.
Okay, all right. Well, let's throw a hardware question out here then. This one goes to Ken at Red Rapids. You mentioned PCI bus noise. Are other interconnects any better? And also, how would you characterize parallel buses, such as that found in a VME chassis or even the PCI bus, versus serial interconnects?
That's actually a very good question. Serial interconnects definitely hold a great deal of promise to reducing that noise, and the primary reason being that you're actually performing the serial-to-parallel conversion inside the FPGA, so it's being done typically at a very low voltage with very low power gates as opposed to the high capacitance output pins of a chip, so you're not going to see the same level of bus noise as you would if you were actually trying to send parallel data over the bus. And with regard to VME, that bus is typically a little bit further removed from the actual radio front end, and typically we've not seen a lot of noise generated from the primary backplane. It's usually the backplane directly connected to the transceiver.
So VME's 2ESST at the 320 megabytes per second theoretical, probably a don't care then when you're talking about removed radio front ends.
Yeah, I wouldn't say a don't care, and particularly if you're building your front end directly as a native VME bus or a VME board as opposed to an add-on card, you're going to be a little bit closer to that noise. But the further away you are from the noise, the better. and the serial buses in particular should be a tremendous improvement.
Okay. Question for GE, since I know you're sitting there quietly waiting and patiently. Some of the recently announced analog-to-digital converters have input bandwidth specifications exceeding 1 gigahertz. If my signals of interest are within... I have to move my cursor here. If my signals of interest are within the converter's input bandwidth, do I still need an analog RF front end?
Well, that's a good question, and it's tempting to say no, you don't. But I think the fact of the matter is that you will still need some characteristics that are best handled by analog hardware, whether that be filtering or gain. Those will still be required. What you can do to really take advantage of the wide input bandwidth on some of the A to D converters is employ a selective bandpass filter on the front end and maybe some low noise amplifier to provide some gain, but then undersample the signal so that what you're dispensing with is the sort of the mixing operation, the down conversion from the RF to some intermediate frequency. There's bound to be associated noise figures and phase noise introduced with any analog component. So if you can get some of those out of the picture, you're looking to improve the performance of the front end. So it's not so much can you dispense with the analog front end, but what are the characteristics of that analog front end that you're going to need?
Okay, very good. Just a couple more questions before all the sand drains out of our clock here. And this goes to everyone here. Can any of you cite some actual examples of real-world in-use SDRs? Anybody care to comment on that?
I'll make the comment that the SDR technology has been actually in use for quite a while in terms of, you know, executing modem algorithms and software with a dedicated hardware front end. I suspect this particular individual is asking whether there are people using a common hardware platform and changing the back end algorithms on the fly, and that's a little more rare, although there are a couple of applications I can think of that use that. But in terms of just the overall architecture of RF converter, digitizer, modem algorithms, and software, those have been around really from the mid-80s.
Okay. Any other comments?
Sure. This is Dom Panascotti from Prism Tech. I think, for example, in terms of commercial wireless, you'll find that that Vanu Incorporated has actually deployed a GSM base station in Texas in the U.S., more than one, but out there to a service provider in Texas. And in terms of military SDR, certainly the JTRS program is beginning to ship radios to soldiers as we speak.
Okay. In fact, I can follow on that. There was a direct audience question talking about Vanu, and the installation I think you're referring to, Dominic, is by MidTech Cellular. In fact, we did an interview with an executive from MidTech Cellular and published it earlier this year where they talk about Vanu's technology and helping them to implement multiple waveforms in rural cellular base stations. Anyone else want to comment on actual SDR implementations before we move to the last two questions? No. Okay. This is for everybody here, and this is an interesting question. As the CPU vendors such as Intel, AMD, the Power.org partnership, et cetera, migrate to multi-cores, how does this affect SDR implementations?
This is Mark from Zilliqsoft. One of the things that I can tack to that is something that you see more and more in the literature as well, going around people. Developers actually asking for tools that can tackle these multi-core and multi-processor platforms. So really what you're seeing is that the platforms over the past years have been getting more and more complex. And now if you look at the new process coming out from Intel, AMD, but definitely also companies like Texas Instruments, with more and more cores and more additional functionality, things like system on chips, the tools need to actually expand to provide the software developers with the power to actually target these things.
Okay, very good. Well, with that, I'm going to take that as our last question because we're 5 minutes past the hour, and I do appreciate the audience for bearing with us. Normally, we don't run this late, so thank you for sticking with us. That brings us right up beyond our time limit today. I'd like to thank all of our presenters and all of you who've been listening along remotely. As I mentioned at the beginning, we did not have time to address all of your questions, and there are lots of them still remaining here. Somebody may get back in touch with you. One or more of our audience, one or more of our presenters may get back in touch with you to answer your questions individually as appropriate. This e-cast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen. There it is, within 48 hours. Note that an audio-only podcast version will also be available if you'd like to listen along in your car or on an airplane, as I sometimes do. And yes, you can search for Embedded Space E-Cast on iTunes, believe it or not, and find all of OSP's archived e-casts available for download as MP3 files. So there you go. That's it. Sorry that we're late. Thank you all for attending. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too. Our presenters appreciate your attention. We're adjourned. Goodbye.